Well, good afternoon. My name is Michael Berman, and I'm the convener for the session. I want to welcome everyone in the room, and I want to welcome anyone viewing via the online conference. Today, we have the pleasure of hearing from Nicholas Tate. Nicholas is the director of the Research Data Storage Infrastructure Project that's based at the University of Queensland in Australia. And we're very pleased to have him here talking about the subject of demand aggregation, the key to cutting IT costs, a topic that I know is near and dear to my heart. Before I get started, I do want to remind you that there is an online feedback form. It's linked directly to the session if you look online, and you can go in and give your impressions. And I can tell you, being on the program committee this year, that we do use the feedback about the sessions to steer the future conferences, and it also goes back to the speakers, which is very helpful for them, so that they can learn from the experience and continue to work to improve their speaking style. So I really want to strongly encourage you. It does make a difference when you fill out the feedback form. I also want to mention that we'll have some time for questions after Mr. Tate speaks. And I would encourage you to use the microphone in the middle of the room so that the online audience and everyone in the room can hear the question. So at this time, it's my great pleasure to welcome to Philadelphia Nick Tate.
Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be here. Despite some people have seen a clock earlier on, which I left on the original time, it looked like it was 3:20, which it is, but it's 3:21 a.m. In my time at home. So I aim not to fall asleep during my presentation, but I'm sure you'll wake me up if I go at all wrong. What I thought, I'm going to just run through a few of the things that I want to cover. Whoops, today I might go back again. For a moment, just for a second. Just a few thoughts about Australia and New Zealand. Some of you will have heard of it. You might have seen it in the films. But also, there are a few points about what I'm going to talk about and some of the take-up messages that may be useful to understand the context which I'm speaking. I'm going to talk about CORDIT, and I'll come on to that in a minute. But that's the equivalent of EDUCORSE in Australia and New Zealand. I'm going to talk about collaborative procurement that we do. In our environment and some of the lessons that we might take back from up here and more generally. I'm going to talk about a project that I'm running, RDSI. You'll see why as we get to it, but it's driving some of the approaches that we're going to take with demand aggregation. And I'm going to talk about national vendor panels. And these are some of the things I noticed were still being discussed yesterday in the CIO discussion on demand aggregation. Some of those thoughts will come out, I hope, in the discussion today. First of all, Australia. I've taken liberties with this map. Well, actually, our colleagues in ARNET, who are the network group, have, because you'll see that Australia is sort of centred in this particular map, so you can see where it came from. Just the Mercator projection, just so you can see it's a very long way from anywhere. And that's, so to Australians, flying to Hong Kong is 8 hours as a local flight. Quite often, but it does mean that we have some interesting challenges on the network front, which we've largely overcome. But it's about, in terms of, just so you get a context, Australia is about the same size physically as the United States, with the exception perhaps of Alaska, but we have a population of 21 million, so it can be quite empty in places. But it does mean that we have a whole pockets of cities where there's intense activities of industry and of universities, and then great empty spaces. But within that context, you'll see how we perhaps take advantage of that a little way in the way we do some of the strategic procurement. I come from the University of Queensland, which is where I'm based. It's about halfway up the east coast of Australia. Just to put it in perspective, we're just a bit south of the Great Barrier Reef and just slightly north of Surfers Paradise. It's obviously an awful place to be. And this is one of our campuses at the University of Queensland. It's been a long-term goal to be posted to this campus, but unfortunately I'm still at the main campus of the university. This is Heron Island in the Great Barrier Reef, which is genuinely one of that end bit is our campus in the Great Barrier Reef. No doubt it's similar to some of your outlying campuses from your own institutions. Perhaps I might just move on and talk a little bit about CORDIT and what it is we're doing and why would I bring this up or discuss it here today, because much of what I'm going to talk about is some of the strategic procurement or collaborative procurement activities that we've done in CORDIT. CORDIT stands for the Council of Australian university director's information technology, which is not actually quite true because it covers more than just Australia, no doubt a historical name somewhere along the line. But what it does is it's quite a close collaborative body. It is the EDUCORPS equivalent, if you want, in Australia. But of course, we have fewer institutions, and so that makes a slightly different picture. So if I make those up, we have 39 universities and two research institutions in Australia, some New Zealand universities, in Fiji, one university, and in Papua New Guinea, another three universities. There's a couple of other members as well, about 55 members as a whole. In Cordit. And that's a nice number, because actually you tend to know most of the other CIOs in this organization. You know, you could probably talk to most of them, probably phone them up or email them, would actually know many of them. And that's a good way, actually, one of the great ways of doing collaborative activity is to know the group of people with whom, and trust the group of people with whom you're working or collaborating. And so it's a good number. Though we're the same physical size as the US, that smaller population means we have that smaller set of institutions. We have been doing collaborative procurement for a while, about, I think, 15 to 20 years, maybe at least 15 years, probably more. And we've done a number of arrangements. We'll put together a number of arrangements with many vendors that I have up here. We have had some success, and I'm going to come through how we've approached that in a minute, and because I think there may be some lessons for how it could be approached elsewhere if you're not already doing it. You may well be taking similar approaches to preparation. We've actually generated a great deal of benefit out of these, and I'll talk about the ROI in a minute. The most important thing to consider when talking to our colleagues and their partners and colleagues in the vendor community, I really don't want to put you in the, give you the view that we actually treat our vendors in anything other way than as partners in the discussion. We end up having a very good dialogue with them. But the fact is, our vendors need to know that we do hunt as a pack. We go together. So when we're putting together an arrangement, or when we're coming to them, if a vendor decides that they will attempt to go to any one of our universities, it could be half an hour or an hour before someone else knows around the side about what's going on. The fact is, if you have that information flow, it's very difficult for anyone to go and have a disingenuous conversation with any of the individual institutions. It's important for people to understand that you're working together when you do this collaborative processing. And if not, then if you don't do that, then it's going to be very difficult for people to believe, or people will try, vendors sometimes, the less collaborative ones will try and pick off individual institutions. So before you go out and say, well, let's get together as a group and decide to do some form of collaborative procurement or any form of activity, it's a good idea to have done some work on knowing yourself and knowing something about your own organisation. Now, again, of course, I'm aware that EDUCORPS as a whole, and indeed University of Queensland has participated in this, does a lot of benchmarking. The core data survey and other benchmarking helps people understand what you are. Cordit does additional levels, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but just to give an idea, before we started out on much of this, we had to identify, what is the proposition that we're going to put forward when we go discussing with vendors? How much is it worth to the vendor? So first of all, we identified our spend, and clearly that was a discussion and a survey and a lot of data collection. We spend about $1.5 billion Australian dollars, so that will be about $1.6 billion US dollars. Australian dollars slightly higher than the US dollar at the moment. So that will give you an idea of our annual spend on IT, and I think that excludes people. So, as an example, does that matter? Do the vendors care? So the message, when we originally discussed with Microsoft, the message was, look, we're spending about $1.5 billion a year on expenditure. We'd like to talk to you about a deal that relates to the whole of the Australia-New Zealand region. We don't think that we're getting good collaboration. Let's have a discussion. The answer was, certainly. Mr. Balmer will be in town in Sydney, would you like to have a chat with him? And so we went and spent an hour or so with them, and his response was, what is it that we can do? It was actually an open dialogue and an open discussion. But first of all, you need to understand what it is, what's the proposition that you're bringing to this table. And if they know that you're not hunting as a pack, if they know that it doesn't matter that that's your total spend, that they can still, that people can still go to individual institutions and not who may circumvent or may not circumvent what you're doing, then it is harder to take that view. We've also done quite a lot of data in to some extent more depth than the EDUCORE's core survey, and it's not quite the same, and therefore I'm picking my words carefully and meaning to do so. We've gone through a process of understanding, and of course it's particularly true in the United States, as it is in Canada, the UK and other jurisdictions, that universities differ. We understand it in Australia, even though we've got fewer of them, universities differ markedly. One of our largest universities has around 50 to 60,000 students, and our smallest university has, I think, 2 to 3,000 students. So we clearly have a wide range of them, and the complexity of solution, the complexity of activity that each of them undertakes is different. We therefore go through a benchmarking process. I'm not meaning to go through these in detail, but a benchmarking process which allows us to attempt to come up with what we've called a complexity index. And that complexity index allows us to understand what our spend, the spend of our institutions is likely to be. It's all part of knowing yourself, knowing the information about yourself. There's a lot more than that. But one of this does allow, what the complexity index will allow us to look again at how we spend, who spends what level of spending is necessary in each institution. And that's all part of how we can then help predict what we think may occur. And how we should operate with our vendor community. This is just one of the way, part of the way in which we construct that complexity index. And as you can see, what we can do is then analyse, for example, down the left-hand side for these universities, you can see for complexity indexes, I think CI, I'm sorry it's small timing here, I should have we've just had to adjust the resolution here on the screen a bit, but for CI 1 to 2.9, that's complexity index, I'll show you some of that for the universities in a minute, you can see that that's actually a reduction in expenditure, whereas others have got increases in different complexity areas, increase expenditure over the period from 2007 to 2010. There are a number of analyses that we can do which help us when it comes down to knowing more about ourselves when we go and have those discussions with the vendors. And as you can see, these are just showing that in more, in illustrating that we can see in some more detail that, and that's helpful. Now, I've plotted all the various institutions in Australia University. I've thoughtfully taken out the names of the institution because I haven't had a chance to go to 55 institutions and each seek their permission from a privacy point of view to put them up there. I'm not certain it matters. We often do show it. It's fairly open. This is showing the percentage, the total IT percentage, expenditure, as you can see, as a percentage of institutional revenue in 2010. So we understand, well, there's one of them is spending a lot, relatively. I don't know what, and I don't know what the equivalent is in the US. You will, of course, have a much better handle than me, or in Canada, or whatever, but at 17% would be our highest expenditure, and as you can see, down to just under 4%. Now, this, of course, ties up, as part of that, knowing ourselves, this actually shows you the difference between central expenditure, blue, and the faculty or school expenditure. So in other words, how decentralized is the IT? So we understand how that's working in the institutions. You can see that one at 17% is quite decentralized expenditure. There's still a relatively high expenditure. Now, part of that can be, if I move on, we actually then plot our expenditure against institutional complexity. So we understand with that complexity thing, it gives us an idea of understanding whether these are outlying expenditures on a single year, whether we can predict much more our expenditure. And by doing this for our institutions and having, I'm really just showing you very quickly some small outputs from that. By understanding more about ourselves, we're in a position to then discuss that activity with our vendor community in a much better way. So part of the, having understood it, having gone on and understood a bit about what we're doing, part of the discussion you then have to have with a vendor, or we found appropriate a vendor, is to say, well, do we just want to go in, for example, with Microsoft or with VMware, whom we had some interesting discussions with, do we just want to go in and say, well, this is your standard pricing model. We're happy. We're happy to take that and simply shave a bit off it. And actually not. We've tried to be more imaginative and say, well, actually, the way that you're approaching this doesn't seem to us to work for universities. And the bulk of us doing this quite well. I'm, of course, I understand that that cricket is not yet is not currently widely played in the United States, and that though I have to tell you that George Washington is recorded did play cricket, and I understand Abraham Lincoln did as well. So it's clearly a phenomenon that the game has changed in the United States. Indeed, to give an illustration, in Australia, up until I think the 1970s it was, cricket is quite a has a long history and can be quite a staid game. It lasts for 5 days if you've not. The match lasts for 5 days, and it stops for morning tea and lunch and afternoon tea and so on. And some people find that long, and it doesn't always get a result at the end. It's sometimes a draw at the end of the 5 days, and some people get frustrated by that. And at the end, certainly some of the viewing audiences, one of our cricketing magnates decided he would change the game, and he decided he wanted a much shorter, quicker, snappier version of cricket that only lasted a day. For the match, so one day, and this was outrage in the community. But ultimately, that's proved the great saviour, to some extent, of the cricketing environment. We now have lots of different varieties of cricket, and much has changed. The fact is, when we've gone into the vendors, what we've attempted to do is often say, no, it's, for example, with VMware, it doesn't actually. And this was a great discussion we had with them, as we've had with others. We don't want to pay by server. We don't want the model that looks at individual servers, individual users. We actually want a license for the campus. I know many of you will have negotiated these as well, but we want it on a national basis, and we want that campus to be done on what we call an FTE basis, which is, in this case, was staff, a combination of staff and students, as reported. And we'd like simply an unlimited license based on an annual fee for that. They hadn't done that at the time. When we went back and discussed it with them, it was us, because we were operating together, it was possible to get an agreement to do that, and subsequently that's now been the agreements we've had since, I think, 2008 with VMware as a whole. So the message, one of the big messages, one of the early messages that we should take is, actually, by operating together, you can very substantially engage in collaborative procurement, you can very substantially save yourself funding, money, and I'll talk about that, the sort of results of that in a minute, but also you don't need to go in and accept the existing rules of the game, change the game. And as indeed, of course, has happened, as it happens very substantially in Philadelphia, and unless many of you recognize these gentlemen, this is the, it is all gentlemen in those days, I think, this is the Philadelphia cricket team touring England in 1884. Much has changed, I notice, in the summer game in the United States since those days. So some of the products, some of the vendors we've been talking to, and I'm happy to talk about these. I'm not advocating, of course, or detracting from any of them. They're all been a very interesting partnership arrangement with our colleagues in the vendor community. The Microsoft arrangement we've had is, I think, at least 15 years old. That's basically, it looks now similar to your campus agreement. It's saved a very substantial amount of money for the institutions. All but one of our members, I think, now takes, our university members, takes the Microsoft arrangement. So that as a collaborative arrangement is good. Does it make any difference other than pricing? Yes, it does. For example, many of you will have, I imagine many in this community will have outsourced their email to either Google or Microsoft. Student email particularly will have outsourced it. Some of the early issues we had were with the contracting arrangement, contracting terms and conditions that came with the Microsoft, and indeed there was some discussion with the Google one. We ended up going back as a group and negotiating a different contract, which worked for us in Australia and New Zealand for that, and it was the power of operating together to that. So it isn't just the cost, but it's actually many of the other activities. So Microsoft has been one, VMware has been a partner since 2008, Cisco recently came on board, as have HP, Hitachi, Citrix, and Citrix has been there for a while. So each of these are agreements that show how ultimately we've been able to secure strategic agreements. Our strategic agreements are not ones that everybody has to join. We've never felt that would work. In any case, getting, I understand in the US context, for instance, getting 2,500 people to agree all at once would obviously be impossible. However, even, I have to tell you, getting 55 members to agree all on the same thing at once, if the majority of them are universities, is also impossible in any reasonable timescale. And so what we actually do is we set up an arrangement. We're very clear with the vendor that we set up an arrangement in which that arrangement is such that everybody can opt in if they choose to. And what we're getting is a very substantial. So I think, as I mentioned, the Microsoft one is very high opt-in, and it didn't start that way, but it's just gradually gone up. And VMware, I think 37 have now opted in and are increasing. You'll be surprised at how effective it is, but you have to build it over the years to make it work well. So the benefits on some of these areas are worth perhaps discussing. First of all, from our point of view, it reduces the cost of negotiation. Now, that's for both the vendor and for our individual members. We negotiate common terms and conditions. We have done. We've obviously a common price list, but we don't get in the way of an individual institution signing up to that arrangement. In other words, an individual institution still procures, for example, the Microsoft arrangement, but it's done using the common terms and conditions and common pricing that we've agreed. That means from a vendor point of view that they have a one point of contact very largely to deal with. The actual legal contract is separate, but it's a common terms and conditions largely, but the actual contracting agency is different. But at the same time, they really have one group to negotiate with or to agree with. That reduces the vendors and should reduce their cost of sale. It should make it much easier for them to deal with issues, and it makes it much easier for them to hear back from us if we have an issue that needs to be dealt with. And it clearly makes it much better for our individual members. We do not need 50 members having to negotiate separate agreements with any one of our vendors. It simplifies the legal processes. I've heard people say, oh, well, yes, of course, but in the United States we have all of these states and we have a federal government and there are different legal systems. We have exactly the same in Australia. There are fewer states, but each state has its own legal system, a proud tradition of being different from anyone else, as far as we can tell. We all share a similar common law legal system, but as we do with the United States and with Canada and with New Zealand. But, in fact, each one has their own legal jurisdiction. We pick one and make the arrangement in that one jurisdiction. But we can still get a reasonably common set of terms and conditions. I'm going to talk about that in a minute a bit more. And it gives the vendor some certainty. I've just indicated we start knowing ourselves better. And by knowing ourselves better, we're able to understand what the likely spend, what the likely activity is going to be. We don't guarantee it, I might add, but we know more about it and are able to talk about it. Finally, on the ROI, let me give you, when we went back, we were thinking about this within Cordit and the Cordit executive, and we thought, I know, how are we going to decide whether to invest more in some more manpower to drive the strategic procurement forward? Let's look at the benefits and the cost. So the bottom line was the benefits we estimated at $30 million to date of what we've been doing and the costs at $250,000. And we decided that was a reasonable return on investment and invested another small amount more to generate significantly greater benefits. You do generate a great deal of benefits if you want to do it this way. There are other examples of collaboration, and I've talked just about the strategic procurement, and that's one way of demand aggregating. I'm only going to run through these very quickly, but there are other examples that we have in Australia which I think are similar, and I'd encourage you to take advantage, as I'm sure you do, of the things that you have here. So the Australian Access Federation is the equivalent of In Common. In the US it uses similar things. I don't know the exact numbers of members of In Common. I'm sorry, I'm not as up on that as I should. The Australian Access Federation, I think, has all but one of the Australian universities have joined it, and it's joining. So it makes, again, a difference. We can operate commonly on federated identity. Arnet, again, you have Internet 2 and I think National Lambda Rail here in the United States. Canada, of course, has the Canary arrangements and others. In Australia, we commonly, and for over 20 years, the universities have owned a telecommunications carrier called Arnet. It does work for education, but it doesn't just do what you would think of as the interconnection, the Internet 2-like interconnection. It actually also is a full carrier, as in terms of an ISP. It provides full commercial internet provision and seeks to do that for others as well. So we have an equivalent, in fact it's been going rather longer, of REN-ISAC that people have talked about, which is your security group, security, if you like, clearinghouse for issues of security. AusCert's been going for 20 years. All the universities in Cordit subscribe to AusCert, and it provides common security advice across them. It saves the universities a great deal of money. And the subscription is about $2,000 to $3,000 a year, so probably not the most expensive one that you've had to do. And we have others where this one, Higher Ed Services, is a company run by a group of all the universities that as a subsidiary of the group that our presidents actually sit in. But this one has negotiated with Oracle for some common agreements. Oracle can take some time to negotiate with for common agreements, and they're quite well versed at that. I've talked a little bit about some of the collaborative mechanisms we've used. I'm just going to talk in the future before I stop at some point for questions. But I'm just going to talk a bit about where we're going and one of the initiatives we're taking. People will have heard about, I think, particularly if you came to someone like Tony Hayes' presentation or one of them, much of the investment in, and I think it's going to be, it's called cyber infrastructure here, it's called e-science in the UK, it's called e-research in Australia. The Australian government, of course, isn't as wealthy as I'm sure as the US government is, but at the moment it's been investing $400 million for us in our e-research area, which we've done on a collaborative and national basis. And it's invested in these areas that I've indicated here, from federated identity right the way through to the high-speed networks. It's also investing in storage, collaborative storage, and I'll come on to why that's driving what we're doing next, and some of the high-performance computing. And I'm not going to dwell on these other than to say that there are a number of projects going on. And the project that I'm involved in, or director of, is this one at the bottom here, RDSI, Research Data Storage Infrastructure. And that's the intent for that is to provide, think of it as a research storage cloud, and I'm going to discuss that as a minute, for research across all universities in Australia and research institutions. And of course that requires quite a bit of storage. The reason for doing it is so that researchers, if you've been to a number of presentations on any of them, on e-research, you'll see why, from a research point of view, you want to be able to use and manipulate significant collections of data. It makes enormous benefit to the research outcome. We're going to do this in Australia by having a small number of data centres, generally often run by universities, connected together by that very fast network. So ARNET that I showed you earlier, we're upgrading, as I think I heard Internet 2 was, to an 8 terabit network. We're going to connect these at very high speeds, these data centres, effectively generating, think of it as a, if you like, a community storage cloud within Australia. And there's quite a lot of funding coming to that from the government. We're providing, we hope, some consistent storage interfaces, so it begins to sound like a cloud, except politically I'm not in a position to call it that. No. Only quietly if you don't talk about it. The University of Queensland has been appointed lead agent, and for the particular part that we're doing, they've given us $50 million to start the process of building that. Much of the funding, and I don't know whether this is a problem you have in funding that you get in the United States or in Canada, is for infrastructure and can't be used for operations, which has given us some interesting discussions. Which leads me on to the point about how we're expecting to use cloud storage in this case. So, first of all, what I've just described to you is a significant investment in these very highly scalable data centers, which are going to store lots of data. The amount of data, we'll come on to the sort of demand in a minute, but the amount of data is large from any research organization. Operation. I imagine in your own institutions or in the collections of institutions, if you're collaborating on it, you'll have seen the output of some of the very large research instruments. These are storing enormous amounts of data and getting faster. In Australia, there's a discussion within the radio astronomy community, for example, at the moment, between all of them, as to whether to invest in, I think it's either Western Australia or South Africa, to put in place the square kilometre array. that's going to generate so much data that we don't yet know how to store it. So many of the research, so much of the large storage activity, much of the large data activities are being generated from our research activities, not from our enterprise activities, but from the research activities. One of the principles we looked at was how can we've got money to do that, and others are co-investing with us. There's a lot more co-investment to generate this enormous capacity that we're putting in place for research storage. How do we take that, and how do we use this as an anchor point in our vendor arrangements to come to a conclusion that we might manage to benefit all our universities, even those who don't want to put in large amounts of radio astronomy data or whatever it might be, into these storage centres. In addition, we've identified we can't spend the money the government's given us on buying cloud storage from Amazon or from anybody else, because it doesn't fit within the government's definition of infrastructure. What we can do is put in place a gateway that makes sure that we peer or discuss with cloud providers, first of all, a means of peering with our network, after all, the same as you might do with Internet too, but with Arnet. We can also do is have a discussion on demand aggregation, much as I think I see that Internet 2 is doing via the Net Plus initiative for Box.net and others, but in this case for a larger storage thing. And I would very much, one of the things I am going to say is I'd be very much welcome if we, between us, managed to find a way of discussing it jointly, perhaps to a transcontinent discussion with some of our vendors. While we're putting in case a cloud gateway, we will be looking at panels of in order to do demand aggregation as well on cloud storage, as well as the more traditional storage that I'm about to talk about. And so the intention that we're doing using this project is to use this funding as an anchor. And you can do this with any project if you've got a significant spend. Within the project, I'm in a position to dictate how people will spend the money from that project. In other words, I can say that we will establish a panel of vendors, and we've agreed, and when you as a university or a data center receive that money, you must buy off that particular panel. And that's what we're doing to give a core, if you like, a guaranteed amount or of activity that may come to vendors, and establish then a panel of vendors, particularly for storage but also for servers and others, in this case, which will have that, if you like, requirement to be used for this, for my project, the RDSI project, but will be specifically set up to be able to be used more widely for Cordit members, so for all of the members to use it. So in fact, we end up, we hope, having the best of both worlds, increasing the potential volume so that the project wins in getting reduced cost, but actually increasing, using this as an anchor part of the volume to ensure that the whole of the community gets an improvement in its ability to gain pricing and other conditions. So just to give you an idea, so in terms of the storage demand, we think there's about 200 petabytes of storage demand likely out of our scalable nodes, and our members are telling us that over the next few short number of years, they'll want about 500 petabytes of storage. Now, we've done some, again, know yourself. So when we mentioned that to the vendors, we got some interest. And we held a briefing session in Brisbane, and I had to close the doors. But we actually ran out. We ran into the fire regulation, so I had to close the registrations at 140 on that session. But people come, 80 or 90 companies came round for a discussion, and we're doing further discussions. It's been a very popular approach, not only with our members, but with the vendors as well, who have been interested in playing. There are some things that you need to think about. One of the things is when you're giving numbers to vendors, it's always worth having a little bit of a caveat. And what better to do than a very famous Canadian economist based, I think, at Harvard for much of his career. So what more impeccable person could I quote in making that point to the vendors? So we're giving you our best estimates. I'm afraid we're not guaranteeing you any of those. One of the issues is contracts, and I heard some discussion in some of the meetings about the fact that I think many of the contracts in the United States, and I'm not certain how this works in the Canadian provinces, that sometimes the states mandate particular procurement approaches, particular RFPs, particular contracts. We have similar arrangements. What we've been doing is we're trying another approach again on this one. We thought it's all getting too hard. We're lazy people at heart. And we'd really rather not do our own contracts. Who wants to bother your lawyers? They've got more important things to do than be bothered by us half the time. So One of the approaches we found is that governments themselves often have standard contracts. In Australia, this is called the government IT contract, or GITC. Naturally, of course, we've got many governments, so there are many such variants of the contract that would be silly to assume it was just one. We've picked two: the Commonwealth, which is our federal government, if you will, and the state of Queensland, where I am, because actually they have the most advanced of these particular contracts, and said to the vendors, you must be signed up. In order to play on this panel, you must be signed up to one of these two contracts. But none of them have come back with a problem. They're all signed up to both of them, and they're probably going to use the Queensland one. Why would we do that? Because the vendors have already signed this contract with the state governments, who are now maintaining the contract for us. We don't actually have to negotiate a contract at all. We now just have to negotiate the terms for supply, for purchase price, and equipment and services. It makes it much, much easier to do it. And we've had no pushback at all in using those common contracts, and it looks like it's going to save us a fortune in legal fees. And better still, the governments are going to maintain it for us in future. I know that you do this as well, but I talked closely to our local procurement in the state government, to our procurement office at the state government, and explained what we were doing to make sure there was no issue. They came back and said, that's a great idea, can we join you? And the answer was, no, this is educational discount, I'm sorry, but we'll let you know what we're doing. But we had no pushback there either, but engaging them early. And finally, really maintaining the panel is something you have to do and have to continue. Having set up this panel, and having, which we're doing for storage services, a range of services, including, as I say, we'll do for the cloud storage providers, it's important to maintain the panel going forward. The products change, the answers change, and so on. Every 3 months, we're looking to do a allow on and off from people going on and off from the panel. It's I'm always reminded when I talk to the vendors that Einstein, hopefully people recognize, I think became a professor of physics at Princeton after he left Germany. And there's quite a strong story, which I think is true, that one of his physics students came to him one year and said, "But you know, Dr. Einstein, the questions on the physicist's physics paper are the same as the questions on last year's physics paper." And he said, "Well, that's absolutely true, but of course the answers this year are completely different." We have exactly the same issue with our things. We don't keep much of our contracts current. The answer that we have in danger that the procurement offices in our own institutions, without help from us in this way, may be in danger of continuing to ask the same questions and expecting the same sort of answers at the end of the day. Of course, one of the other things to be careful of is that ultimately, when you go into these discussions, you always have to be quite flexible and have to have very good feedback to your community to be able to do the negotiations. As the good Field Marshal found when I think he helped Napoleon lose to the Duke of Wellington at the Battle of Waterloo, no plan sadly survives contact with the enemy, and in this case, no absolute plan survives contact with your colleagues in the negotiation setting. That really covers, I think, all of the areas, what we've been doing in Australia and New Zealand, I should say, we've attempted to use the ability to know ourselves and undertake collaborative purchasing to generate very significant savings, but more importantly, to also generate a change in the way that we establish our discussion with vendors, our dialogue. We have strong dialogue with them. If we have an issue, we can raise it immediately. If we have a contractual issue or a technical issue, we get somebody will listen and will come back to us in any of these arrangements, and they will change things if they know we're all coming together. We hunt as a pack, and if I leave you with no other message than that, it's important to think that it is perfectly possible to achieve significant savings, to achieve significant changes in behaviour, as a win-win, not as a we're going to win and the vendors are going to go broke, that doesn't help anybody, but as a win-win for both sides. But you need to go at it in a way that actually is designed to arrive at an end solution. It's not an instant overnight fix. You must keep doing it. And of course, many of you may be doing this regionally as well. We found doing it nationally makes a very big difference, though of course we're smaller. So I'm living in hope, of course, of being posted to our particular campus out there in the Great Barrier Reef. But in the meantime, I'd be delighted to answer any questions. I think, as somebody suggested, we should use the microphone because of the streaming audience. Ah, oh, there we are.
Yes, I've been to your fair campus, the Bing one, not this one. Good question, the PAC. Does the PAC have like an administrative arm? Because this sounds like a big, dedicated job to administrate, make sure that the vendors are following through, that Papua New Guinea is still doing the same thing that New Zealand, and how does that work?
Okay, that's a good question. Thank you. I hope everybody heard that. The way that it works is we have, that was when we did that ROI calculation, that benefits calculation, that was to allow Cordit to take on one full-time staff member to run this. And we have one full-time strategic procurement manager who works on all of these activities. Within Cordit, we have a standing committee on procurement, and that's like a volunteer committee. See, I chair that committee. There's about two other people on it. So this is not that's quite a light load. The majority of the heavy lifting is done by our strategic procurement manager, who is an employee of Cordit or works for Cordit. So we use one FTE to do what we've been describing to you.
So, Nick, I've been involved in California and doing some similar things with some of the other California institutions. And one of the difficulties we sometimes run into, as you talked about predicting demand, is the vendors will say, well, if you can guarantee you can get this many institutions in on the deal, then we'll guarantee this price. And then we say, well, but we don't know how many institutions we're going to get until we put the price out there and see, and it's somewhat voluntary. And I'm just curious if you have suggestions for how to frame those conversations with the vendors to try to get them to a conclusion instead of just going around in circles on that issue.
Yep. Thank you. Yeah, it's a good, very good question, a very good point. We never, ever guarantee any number of vendors because we can't. We simply couldn't act in such a way as to say that the members of Cordit, we're not empowered in any way to do so, will all take it up. We can give an indication by asking early discussions, and we would do that. The other thing we have done, and we have agreed with vendors, is that sometimes what we agree is that the deal cuts in at a certain minimum number. So we're not guaranteeing it, but we're saying that if the deal gets to, you know, 8 or 10 or whatever pick a number, it just depends on the arrangement, it gets to that level, then the deal's on. If it doesn't get to that level, then the deal's off. And sometimes the vendors feel more comfortable with dealing with it that way. But in general, that's only the first time, because if a deal's any good at all, if it isn't any good, it's going to go away and nobody's going to use it. If it's any good at all, people start going on. When we started, I think, with the Microsoft arrangement, we had about 19 or 20 institutions, now all but one are using it. The fact is that as it develops, these things develop over time, and one of the things you have to do is, I think, show that that's the case, that it is developing over time, and that this is a long-term discussion and a long-term play for both us as the institutions and as the vendors themselves.
Hi, you mentioned that it's important for the vendors to understand that you sort of travel in a pack and purchase in a pack. And I was curious about turnover or changes. How do you onboard somebody new to the organization to help them understand that that's vital to the negotiating power that you have?
By that, I mean, just if I can ask you a question back, it's a common trick, isn't it? Just ask you if you're meaning by that the institutions, in other words, turnover within the universities or the members of Cordit. Is that what you're meaning?
Correct. Those people that are participating in that effort.
Yes. So in this case, Cordit is represented by the CIOs at each level. So clearly CIOs do change over time as well. And we do have a system, actually, which works with CIOs and the people below them as well. So there's often reasonable institutional knowledge. But if not, as new CIOs come into Cordit, there's a sort of buddy system for other CIOs who bring them up to speed on what the organization's doing. And the other big thing is that we drink a lot together at the meetings. This will come as a shock, I know, to those who don't know Australians particularly well. But There is quite a lot of that, and you'll find it becomes, as I said, almost everybody then gets to know, really does know almost everybody else. It doesn't take very long for people to come on board, and provided you've also gone to the level down, some level of corporate memory remains, but we're very careful to go back and ensure that individuals, new people coming on, do get one of their local CIOs, drops around for a coffee or a lunch or whatever it is, and starts bringing them up to date with what's going on. And that works reasonably well. The other thing is that the benefit, it doesn't take long to show that the benefits of doing this work. I mean, we don't all do this just because we want to feel better in the morning about collaborating. I mean, that may be a great goal, but it isn't likely to motivate every CIO. What will motivate almost every CIO is if they know that by going through this process that they will then be in a position to save money. And that does motivate people, and that is very quickly and easily able to be explained. And if there are more tricky questions on that area, I think I see the president of Cordit sitting at the back trying to avoid my gaze at the back. So I'll generate any further questions on that one to him if we get stuck on.
Hi, Nick. Jonathan Troutman, Monash University, Australia. I'll disclose my interest from the top.
Yeah. It's good to be public disclosure, yeah, full at the front.
My university is probably a member of this, but I'm not in the procurement committee, so my question is
your university is a member of it, yes.
Yeah, I thought that would be. My question is kind of double-barreled. Because you hunt in packs and the vendors know you're coming, to try and get something back, do they try and lock you into contracts? And number two, do others just simply not deal with you? Because I know coming from a corporate background, as a vendor...
All of these, yes.
They often do not say, well, we're not going to deal with government or these people, and especially since educational institutions typically get a large discount anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, you saw some of the vendors up there, and your colleagues in Monash would be aware of some of them that are dealt with. So, first of all, there are a number of ways to approach this. There's the way of approaching this, which is we can see a need to have initiate a dialogue within Cordit as a whole or the IT directors and the community as a whole. There's a need to go and initiate a dialogue, so go and talk to a vendor. That's one way. Another way is that quite often you find that a CIO is actually negotiating already on behalf of their institution, and what you do is go in and help them and say, well, if you're negotiating for the institution, why don't we make this a negotiation which can be used by other institutions as well? And then you have the genesis of an approach which is commonly available. The third way is perhaps more controversial, but it simply says one of the things that is so good in our system is competition. And sometimes we have one or two vendors, we have had examples of vendors who felt unable or unmoved by the benefits of dealing with the universities as a whole. But it's remarkable if you're able, and that's when I say we might initiate a strategic discussion, it's remarkable if one or two of their competitors sign up an overall arrangement, how quickly they discover the need to come back and do it. And we've had a number of instances where, by going in one case, you go and sign up effectively someone who's more of an aspirant in the market and has nothing to lose by signing up for a national arrangement, and then somebody who's more established and has more to lose suddenly feels the need to come back and talk to you. And it does actually work. Not all the time, but it does work reasonably frequently. Any other questions? Excellent. It must be time for tea. Thanks, Rick.